I think we need new skills and maybe new types of people, for sure, more diverse types of people.
My guest today is a serial entrepreneur, behavioral science expert, and in her current roles, impactful in the intersections of communication, government, politics, technologies, women's issues, and behavioral change. As a former public servant, she has advised CEOs, Nobel Peace Prize winners, and politicians. She is founder and board member of apolitical.co, and she is CEO of Apolitical Foundation, dedicated to remaking political leadership for the 21st century. It is truly an honor to have her on my podcast show. Hello and welcome, Lisa Witter.
It's really, really nice to be here. Excited for this conversation.
Lisa, you have such an impressive career, cover so many roles. We won't be able to cover all that here in this short podcast. Can you briefly describe what you do?
Thank you. I mean, I'm always a little thrown off when people talk about me and a career. I never meant to have a career. It's quite funny. Like, that whole concept of a career wasn't something that was I was thinking about in my life. My mom made toilet paper for 45 years. She was a member of the union. She would never say she had a career. She had a job. My dad was a mechanic, ended up being a manager, but he didn't have a career. He had a job. And so I didn't go out to make a career. I just went out to do what I thought I could do something at, that I was like good at and that the world needed. That was like the intersection. Mm-hmm. And just as a quick backup, Kai, like, I think what's really important to me is, and one of the reasons I care so much about women, but it's not just women, it's about like getting the most out of human beings, which I think is something that you care so deeply about in your work. And now I translate that to politics is, you know, I'm very lucky to be born in 1973 in the United States, where there was legislation that said that girls had to have an equal chance at sports than boys. And so I learned how to win, how to lose, how to be powerful, how to strategize. And I also went to church every Sunday with my grandmother, grew up reading the Bible, being not, I wouldn't say super religious, but like guided by the philosophy in the mm-hmm. community. And if you love winning and you love helping people, you go into politics. So I call myself a political entrepreneur. Not that that thing is really exists. I think, you know, it's just something that I made up, and only that I keep thinking about how do you look at challenges, opportunities, constraints, and build new things or improve old things to have breakthroughs. So all my life, I've worked inside and outside of politics. Politics is where there's power. You do politics to actually pass legislation to change the human operating system in our democracy.
So the currency of politics is power.
It is power. Mm-hmm. Power, and I'm not afraid to say that. I don't think power is necessarily bad at all. I think it's who has it and how it's used and how it's checked. And this is for a longer conversation, and maybe we can get into the neuroscience of what power does to the brain, because I think this is an exciting time to be asking these questions, because we know more than we ever have, particularly with artificial intelligence and how that's going to impact how we think about power in the brain and who has power. And about, I don't know, 15 years ago, I started getting very worried that these traditional ways of thinking about politics are falling apart, but people on the left and the right, let's say that that's the dialectical, the more than that, didn't trust government or politics. They're all bad. They're all dumb. They're all ineffective. And I got very worried that if we were only telling the part that wasn't working and the part that, and not the part that was working, and helping the part that wasn't working change kind of quickly, we would be in trouble. So I co-founded a technology company. It's the world's largest peer-to-peer learning platform for public servants called Apolitical. So roughly 300,000 members in 170 countries, under the premise that any group of people, there's wisdom in crowds, and we shouldn't treat public servants as people only hearing from academics or just from other stakeholders. There should be a space where they can learn from one another. So we do a lot on climate, AI, you know, this brings that. Me,
perhaps one question. Who is part of this community? You talk about 350,000 people. Who is joining or who is part of apolitical.co?
The thing that binds them all together is public service. So I would say about 95 of our public service members, 95% of them come from kind of career public servants. So they're civil servants. And about 3 to 5% are politicians, so elected leaders. And it's really, they're young, they're old, they're senior, they're brand new to government, they're men, they're women. Quite interestingly, one of the largest learning groups we have is people who are interested in using AI in government. But in terms of like identity groups, the largest group we have are neurodiverse people in government. So we kind of hold all of those skills, desires, identities in terms of like, isn't that interesting if we have this large percentage of people who have neurodiversity working in government? How do we manage and design for them?
Yes. So what I would like to focus on, what you just indicated, that it's an interesting research phenomenon about what does power with our brain and how does AI impact on neuro systems. Could you just perhaps outline briefly on that one?
Sure. So maybe I'll just take a step back and just briefly say that the company, Apolitical, works on this peer-to-peer platform working with public servants. Mm-hmm. And I now run our foundation called the Apolitical Foundation, which you explained to your listeners. We're working on 21st century political leadership. Mm-hmm. Do you say, what's different now about being a politician than there was in the 18th century or the 19th century or the 20th century? So who do we look for? What are the different skills you need? What's changed? Okay, so, you know, there's been a saying for a long time in politics, anyone who's studied political science, history, philosophy, that absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I've been quite interested in, okay, if that's a feature and not a bug, and it might be, or is it? So let's start there. So there's some research that's been done, and I'm happy to share some of this in the show notes. This isn't my research. This comes out of Berkeley, where they were looking at what happens to people with power. So they started observing people in different makes of cars. And so to make a very long story short, if you had a more expensive and or prestigious make of car, you were less likely to stop for a pedestrian at a zebra crossing. Mm-hmm. And so when you get into the science of break this down, one of the things that we know is that in order for humans to survive throughout history, one of the things we've needed to do is to collaborate. We would need each other to survive. Mm-hmm. One thing to be effective at in collaboration is to have empathy. So let's just think for a moment, what happens when you no longer need people to survive? Your empathy goes down, and so your ability to be powerful in non-only selfish ways and ways that benefit more than just the group reduces. So for me as an entrepreneur, that's a really interesting thing. If that's the case, then you know, rewiring our brains for empathy, thinking about hacking our neurobiology, that probably is going to happen in transhumanism. That's for maybe another podcast. But what we can do is say, okay, what are the types of political leaders that will be less likely to move quickly into that less empathetic role?
That'd now, be interesting to know.
Yeah. So one thing you talk about, one thing you look at is, okay, people come from disadvantaged backgrounds, right? Because they're always going to be in a disadvantaged background, whether they're in the power position or not. So maybe can you redesign things so that politicians are spending more time doing average people things, like taking the subway or buying their own groceries? So there's lots of mitigations. Can you make sure that their teams aren't just the same old political hacks that are around them? Can you take people from their communities? And how do you make sure that they don't end up becoming corrupted by power? So I think all these insights from social science, behavioral science, neuroscience are going to help us screen, find, support, and redesign the systems better.
Now, if we would use this knowledge, you talk about these scientific research studies from Berkeley and so on, what would that mean for future training programs for leaders?
Well, Kai, I started my first what we now call political leadership incubator about 30 years ago because I noticed that my political party in the United States where I was, while well-intended, was recruiting people to win, elections. Okay, I understand that's an important thing. But then they were training them how to win elections instead of how to be transformational leaders and how to be effective policymakers, which is pretty important. That's why you do the job. And that's getting more complex now. I mean, just think now, if you're a mayor of a city, you're in geopolitics like you weren't 20 years ago, right? It's very different.
Right.
So me and others have sort of built this growing movement, and it's what we're doing at Apolitical, to rethink how we prepare these political leaders. And I'll tell you the biggest mistake I made. I made the mistake of thinking that the most important thing we can do for leadership in politics was to train people. And I think one of the most important things we can do is A, signal that it's an important role and that if you take it, you have to be ready for the job, meaning emotionally ready and intellectually ready. And that doesn't mean that you have to be like the smartest person in the world, but you have to have an agile mindset. You have to be self-reflective. You have to know your limits. Mm-hmm. You have to have these sort of soft, and you have to be a great communicator. So I didn't do a good enough job, kind of curious what you think about this, like in screening the right leaders for the right roles. And now I think we're getting much better at that.
Yeah. Perhaps I can share some of my experiences here. You know, as you know, I've been working as a coach for politicians here in Germany and Europe for many years. And I often experience a great ambivalence with politicians. On the one hand side, they come here in coaching sessions, open up, because I feel a great longing to have that safe space, finally finding somebody who listens to then be ready to open up. One part of the story. The other part is that I sense there's a great resistance. There's even doubt. They have been trained in mistrusting. It's almost an unconscious, perhaps, bias in their head not to openly really share their fears, perhaps, their sadness they might have. I sense this, but I never hear this. So at the very end, I think I would agree, there's nothing you can train mindsets, but you have to create safe environments. And perhaps this is one of my approaches, how I would, if I work with politicians, first of all, build up a trustful environment.
Yeah, I mean, we looked into this a bit through a phenomenon that's been growing around the world on the violence, both online and offline, against politicians. I had a good friend. She was a friend and a parent to many, an MP named Joe Cox, who was murdered during the height of the tension around Brexit. And as I've been talking to politicians around the world, left, right, old, young, north, south, east, west, it doesn't matter, the amount of hate against politicians that's very much scaled with the internet, and there's a lot of stuff going on in this, is increasing. And so I was, A, seeing a lot of good people not go into politics and a lot of people come out of politics because they were tired of the death threats. Mm-hmm. But then if you think about brain and behavioral science, like this conversation we've just had, you know that if your brain is in fight or flight mode, you have a harder time managing complexity and making good decisions. So we did the first ever study on the mental well-being of politicians and why it matters to the citizens. And what we found out was that in general, the scoring data that we had, real researchers doing this, put the mental well-being of politicians lower than first responders. So the person at an accident, at a no-fault, the first person's there. Think about like how stressful that is. It's a hard job seeing what they see, and politicians were there. Yet what was very exciting, and then I have a question for you, is that besides, like, even that being the case, they still felt it was such an honor to serve their citizens, and they were staying in it. So we've been running these online safety courses and offline safety courses, helping them think about safety. And why, Kai, we call them that is if we were to say this is a mental well-being retreat for a politician, no one would show up. If the citizens found out that that maybe they have a mental well-being problem. So I'm just curious, like, how you see, what ideas you have on scaling the support for good mental well-being, for good sort of clarity of thinking, a good, like, taking care of your body. Like, what's working, do you see, with politicians where they're not under threat mode all the time? Do you know of any?
But very interesting. Well, personally, if I work in coachings, I touch aspects of how do you recover? Where do you recharge your batteries? If something changes, like a circular question, I would ask them, now imagine we move on with a coaching and something changes. Who would observe this change? How could it benefit the relations, private or professional? So I do touch aspects of physical experiences, of embodiment techniques I sometimes use. Where do you feel the stress? How would you move if there was no stress? You know, I start with very subtle approaches, but, you know, having very rational people in front of me, it already creates a little bit of spooky. You know, what is he doing? Why embodiment? What do you do with me? So many believe it's all about rational answers. It's about learning how to give answers, how to deal with media instead of reflecting. And so in one-on-ones, it's not easy to really touch this holistic approach unless you work with somebody, which I'm happy to know at least three politicians, quite impactful ones, who have been coming to see me for over 3 years now. So there has been developed a true trustful relationship. But in short trainings or coachings, I would say it's impossible. It's more of the same, as Paul Watzlawick would say. You rather see these people expect how to give some more top 10 tips how to survive. This has nothing to do with well-being. How would you define well-being, by the way?
That's a really good question. It's usually a question that I ask back to people saying, how would you define your well-being, right? Because it's yeah, really interesting.
It's individual. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I am an entrepreneur by accident, like I told you. And to be an entrepreneur, you have to deal with large parts of scarcity and want a lot of agency. I mean, there's a reason why I'm an entrepreneur. I don't like necessarily working for big things telling me what to do. So I learned at a very young age, being an athlete, that like having stress was a fuel for my performance. So for me, stressful situations, it's a reframe.
Right.
Other people are like, oh my God, like this is such a stressful role. And then I'm like, well, then you should not be a politician. You have to see the stress as an opportunity. There's a tilt phase, right, where your performance goes down. So I think a lot of what I'm a brain-based neuroleadership coach, started doing leadership work when I was probably 5 or 6 within my church. I didn't know that, but very young, like around the age of 9 or 10, there were a lot of gun deaths in my neighborhood, and kids killed with guns. They killed themselves. They were killed. Gun deaths. Yeah. Like just tons of gun violence. Like, you know, grew up in the U.S. And so they picked a bunch of us to be natural helpers. And I was a kid who was kind of geeky in school, but also an athlete. And so I had like a lot of these buckets. So I kind of learned how to begin to do coaching and listening accidentally at a very, very young age. I do want to go back to this point you said that, and it's different because I work globally. So I see kind of the, you know, I work with Latinos or Africans or Americans or, you know, Filipinos or whatever. But this hyper enlightened intellectualism, like cognitive approach to politics has limits, right? We now know, I worked very closely, I was a student, not in school, but in practical, of a guy named George Lakoff, who wrote a book called Don't Think of an Elephant. It's a cognitive scientist. And so we think a lot about how decisions are made. And what we know is that you need emotions to make decisions. And you get better decisions when you have diversity. And so a lot of the work I have been doing is looking at how do we get different people into politics so that we have better decision-making processes and this is critical. I mean, if you look at the statistics, you'll know this better. But in Germany, I think 2/3 of the MPs are lawyers. Now, that's going to be a huge limit to our ability to solve problems if we all have the same training about how to look about the problem. And that's with AI, what I'm more interested in is people's approach to thinking than the knowledge that they have in their hard drive, because the hard drive is going to be outsourced. You're going to need to have some hard driveness, right? But we don't need to memorize things we used to. What you're going to need to do is to be able to solve human problems together. So we need different types of people who aren't just worried about getting the right answer, because the right answer will be able to be synthesized, but then deliver it, make people feel comfortable. So I think we need new skills and maybe new types of people, for sure, more diverse types of people.
So what I hear is that you think that through AI, it is possible to somehow outsource rational aspects and have more time and more readiness for the relationship side?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have all of the concerns. I mean, there's a zillion podcasts, Kai, you and I could be listening to about, is it ethical? Is it good? Is all of these things. But I do know that just even layman's use of AI with like basic prompt engineering or just learning how to ask smart questions, you can synthesize things pretty quickly that used to take, you know, months to sort of figure out how to do. So.
Right.
I think we need AI should be augmented intelligence, not artificial intelligence, because we are going to need human intelligence to guide us through, I would say, a polycrisis that we're in right now, but just the future of humans. I mean, I think there's a larger sort of discussion to have, like, should we be becoming transhumans? Should we have those chips literally embedded in ourselves so there's not a machine that's far away from us? And these are questions that policymakers are going to need to ask. But I do think we need to get much more of these synthesis, communications, human skills that are really going to make a difference in our ability to implement some of these ideas.
Yes. I have one more question. As you, I mentioned that, focus a lot on women's issues. Just as a hypothetical question, just imagine what would change from your experience and what would you expect, let's say from one day to the other, if we had 50% in political leadership, women?
Yeah, I mean,
would that change?
Well, what we know is that when you get diversity of different opinions, you get better outcomes just in general. So I am not, I want you to know, Kai, I am not saying that the only sort of diversity we should have is more
gender.
Women. Gender. I think we need all types of diversity. Mm-hmm. It is a diversity that is a pretty big one, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we need more people from poor backgrounds. So I'm just going to give some data for you. There was a Pew Research that did a global survey recently that asked people sort of what would happen if we had these different groups, more people elected. So things would get, for women, 50% said that things would get better. 5% said, 8% worse. From poor backgrounds, 46% was said get better, 15 worse. Young people, 46% said would improve, 18% said it would get worse. Business people, 33% better, and 26% worse, and so on. So I think there's a craving that people have to get different life perspectives and different modalities of thinking. But I'll tell you very specifically, we know for a fact that when women are involved, when we elect more women, there are stricter climate policies. So you can say whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm quite worried about the CO2 and how we deal with that. So that is really important. Human needs are often more, like direct basic and human needs are often more brought because they're just closer to this experience. You have better health outcomes often because we're legislating on understanding. You know, it's been kind of weird that most of, I'm a woman and that most of the decisions made about medical have been made by, I don't blame men, but they don't know what it's like to be a woman. So for me, I advocate for all types of diversity, not just gender. And I think that's where we'll have better outcomes in representative democracy. I do think, maybe for a future podcast, is representative democracy in the future our way forward, or do we need to have blended representative democracy with more citizen engagement, AI augmented? I think now's the time, with trust being so low, to not just get marginally better at the type of politics we have now. We need to do that. But I think we need to reimagine new ways of thinking about how we govern ourselves in this very complex planet.
Wow. Yeah, fully agree to that one. We approach the end of this podcast. Lisa, one last question. You just mentioned the word trust. May I ask you, if you meet someone for the first time, just imagine you approach somebody you have never met before, based on which aspects of his or her behavior would you come to the sense of, or the inner conclusion of, I trust this person? What makes trust for you?
You set up the question really nicely in that trust is proximal, right? So trust is often how close one is to something, and close in every sense, not just physically close, but do they look like me? Which is why sort of racism is so hard, right? Because you're looking for all the signals that it's proximal. You have the same life experience. Are you around my age? Do we like the same clothes? So I kind of push myself to be aware of that and push past that a little bit. Mm-hmm. But particularly right now, in an era of a lot of polarization, I'm American, so it's even more, but you even feel it in Germany right now. This is a bit post-COVID. What I'm looking for is the ease, and I don't judge it if it's good or bad, but just how much I can trust them, the ease they have in looking me in the eye, the ease they have in showing curiosity in others. It doesn't need to be me. Like genuine curiosity. Like if someone explains the world to me, I'm less likely to trust them. I'm interested in brilliance. Like I love what you have to say, but I want us to be learning from each other. So that's to me, there's like the subconscious happens, you know, the systems too, Danny Kahneman, like what you don't know mm-hmm. that's happening mm-hmm. that I try to be aware of. But I very actively, particularly now, smile with my eyes. You know, Germans do this. You know, smile with your eyes, which is great during COVID because Americans just do it with their mouth. So I learned how to
that
smile
was a
with
training
my
period.
Eyes. It was a training period for me. I adapted. I had to innovate with the constraint. I wasn't sad about it. I learned a new skill, right? Like this is what we have to do. So I think all of us need to go from subconscious to much more conscious new habit building and trust building by at least smiling at each other. Kai, you are a warm, friendly, open, you just exude, I want to talk to you and I want to be vulnerable with you because I think you're going to hold that in a container. And we need more people like you working with really powerful people because they have very hard jobs right now.
Lisa, thank you so much for these warm words at the very end of my podcast. I think we collected many more topics that are worth considering a second or third episode. Thank you so much for now, for today. All the best for you, Lisa. Great to have you here in this podcast show.
Thanks. And everyone listening, please keep hope. Yeah. I will share with you, Kai, I just wrote a piece on hard hope with curiosity at its core. And I think it's time for us to have a lot of hard hope.
That's it for today. Thanks everyone for listening and for joining my show today featuring Lisa Witter. Bye-bye. Keep up the hard hope and talk to you soon. I'm Kai Kochmann.